Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
This is Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Now, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and following up on last week's Supreme Court ruling, following up on the hysterical bloviations, particularly of Newt Gingrich. What's this guy doing on national television? He's not even in political office. He's a hack, a political hack and a has-been, who's paid a stipend by Fox News and hangs out with the McCain campaign, and he's being treated like,
one of the leading commentators on American policy.
And he comes on to Face the Nation or Meet the Press or whatever it was, makes these outrageous, statements, never gets challenged on them. We will share with you some clips from that and some follow-up on what this has to do with the Constitution in just a moment. First, Jeremy Scahill is in town. He's speaking today at noon before the Pacific time. It's now a little after 9 a.m. Pacific time, noon Eastern time. He's going to be speaking today at noon before the World Affairs Council of Oregon at the Mac Club. It's sold out, by the way, for our Portland listeners. He's also the author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, an extraordinary book of, I forget the old phrase, but anyway, it's an extraordinary, well done.
It's a long book, too.
It's a long book, yeah. It actually, it's irrefutable is the mind-boggling thing about it. I was astounded when I interviewed the number two guy at Blackwater, and he said he didn't know much about you.
Right. Well, no. What he actually said was that I don't know anything about Blackwater. You interviewed Martin Strong, who's the vice president of the company. And after he was on your show, I actually emailed Ann Terrell, the spokesperson for Blackwater, and reminded her that Blackwater has never granted me an official interview with any of its executives. And I said, seeing that Mr. Strong believes I know absolutely nothing about Blackwater, I look forward to my interviews with Eric Prince, Joseph Schmitz, Kofor Black, Mr. Strong himself. I never heard back from them.
Yeah. Yeah, surprise!
I was surprised that they came on your show, Tom. They usually spend their time talking to the O'Reillys of the world.
Yeah, well, I don't know what happened, but we got a good one. It was interesting. As the Supreme Court is pulling in the string on the Bush administration and basically saying, no, you have to do these things legally, you have to do these things, and now McClatchy Newspapers has done this investigation finding extraordinary amounts and levels of physical and psychological torture happening, particularly at Bagram Air Force Base, in Guantanamo Bay and other places, detainees under U.S. Custody. Much of what happened at Abu Ghraib and others seems to be that there were contractors involved in this stuff. To what extent is there a contractor link into this, and how might that be used in the future, particularly if these companies develop offshore operations,
right,
to get around the Supreme Court ruling by, you know, if God forbid, John McCain were elected and we maintain this kind of semi-fascist, neo-fascist route of turning everything over to corporations and having basically a lawless state?
Well, the way I see it is that the Guantanamo and torture policy is one fist, and then the unaccountable mercenaries, that's the other fist. I mean, this is an accountability-free zone right now that Bush and his cronies are operating. On the one hand, you have the lowest people on the pole being hit for Abu Ghraib and torture policies, the people that set the policies for it, and the contractors that are alleged to have been involved with it, nothing happens to them. And then on the flip side, you have prisoners that are being detained with no access to any kind of human rights. Finally, the Center for Constitutional Rights was able to win this victory, and it was a narrow victory at the Supreme Court, granting the right of habeas corpus to these individuals. But at the same time, we have an army of 180,000 so-called private contractors in Iraq that have not been held accountable under any law whatsoever. Tens of thousands of them are armed individuals. And so some legal analysts have argued that the Blackwaters of the world could be classified as, in fact, enemy combatants. But the whole point of this system,
but they won't
is that, no, they won't be. But in terms of a sort of if using the Bush administration's logic,
right. Using the Bush administration's logic, you and I could be termed enemy combatants.
I was with Cy Hirsch the other night in New York, and Cy said in a very somber way, we have never had a government like this in the history of the country. And what he was implying is we've never had a government that has so aggressively tried to quash civil rights, civil liberties. People say, well, could we have a coup in this country? Would that we had a political leader in Washington that would make these guys think they needed to enact a coup? It's a quiet coup.
I would submit to you that the coup happened in 2000.
It did.
It was done by the Supreme Court. And then it happened again in 2004. And the question is, are we going to unwind the coup? And I would disagree with Cy Hirsch. I would say the John Adams administration was nearly as bad, or arguably worse, because he was shutting down newspapers and putting newspaper publishers in jail for saying things like that he was balding. But nonetheless.
Paul Bremer was doing that in Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite a stretch, to go all the way back to John Adams.
You have to go very far.
Yeah. But the issue that this raises is privatization. You know, the old Mussolini standard that fascism is when government and corporate functions merge. I mean, that was the Merriam-Webster dictionary definition up until 1987, when the dictionary company was sold to a multinational corporation, was that fascism was the merger of state and business and interests combined with belligerent nationalism. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're seeing here. And you made the point earlier when we were talking to KPOJ that 70% of our intelligence service is now private corporations like Blackwater.
Right. The combined budget of the 16 U.S. intelligence agencies, we don't know exactly what that number is because it's a black budget, somewhere between $40 and $60 billion, perhaps even more. 70% of that is in the hands of private contractors. These are for-profit corporations that are involved at every level of the gathering and presentation of U.S. intelligence.
And these corporations have as their first goal to make money.
Right.
So what happens if a private corporation says, you know, the way that we'll make the most money is if we have a war someplace? So let's give information to George W. Bush, who's inclined to have a war anyway. Let's give him information that Iraq or Iran is developing weapons of mass destruction so that he'll go have his war so that we'll get another couple $100 billion in contracts, which is exactly what happened. Everybody's talking about, well, the intelligence was so bad. Well, if 70% of the intelligence was corporate.
Right.
Is this a science fiction scenario, Jeremy Scahill?
I mean, look, you have what are called green badgers walking around the CIA, people who have been given a security clearance, but they're from private corporations. Eric Prince, the owner of Blackwater, has been allowed to walk around U.S. intelligence agencies and essentially push Blackwater's goods and services. That's standard across the board. I mean, we have never had such a radically privatized society in this country, and now it's at the most sensitive levels. If I was a traditional conservative, if I was a John McCain supporter, this would outrage me, because what is to prevent a company from injecting tainted intelligence into the presidential daily briefing or another intelligence forum?
Well, that's my question. What if it's already happened? The war in Iraq is the result of this?
Well, no one has really taken on this aspect of it, because people just say, oh, well, it was the CIA and faulty intelligence. That's a tiny, tiny part of the narrative, and it's a dramatic oversimplification. We need to investigate what companies were involved with the presentation of intelligence to the Bush administration and to the Congress in the lead up to the invasion and occupation of Iraq. We know that these companies have been deeply involved with this, and the fact that we see this cronyism, these no-bid contracts, the billions of dollars paid to companies run by the president's friends, these are serious questions. No one has investigated this.
And the 70% number, that's, explain that.
It's 70% of the combined budget of the 16 intelligence agencies in the United States
is ending up in the pockets of private contractors.
Yeah,
so we don't know
70% of the business is being farmed out to the private sector, and
right.
Over half of the National Clandestine Service, they're contractors.
Over half of the National Clandestine Service. So we don't have any specific way of knowing how much of the information that went to George Bush's desk, you know, from the infamous August 6th memo of Bin Laden, determined to strike in the U.S.
How much of that came via
private corporations?
We don't know, but I think that the Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence in the House should aggressively be investigating this, because there is no question that for-profit corporations are involved with this.
Barack Obama introduced legislation to either stop or highlight this. Are there any other members of Congress? I would think Russ Feingold would be all over this. I think Henry Waxman would be all over it. Pat Leahy. I mean, are there members of Congress who are actively looking into this?
I would say that the single strongest member of Congress on this issue is Representative Jan Schakowsky in the House, who happens to be on the Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Jan Schakowsky has been the single most aggressive legislator in the Congress on this. She understands it hands down better than any other member of Congress.
She's been on this program a couple of times talking about these issues broadly, but she's perceived as a lone voice and not a particularly high-profile voice.
She's a national campaign co-chair of Obama's campaign and certainly has sway there. I'm hoping she'll press
that's
him.
That's a great sign. Yeah. Well, now you're giving us a little hope here, Jeremy. Jeremy Scahill, he's the author, now out in paperback, winner of the George Polk Book Award, Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. And Jeremy, thanks a lot for coming out
today. Thank you, Tom. Thanks for everything you do.
And everything you're doing. Great to have you with us. We'll be back with Newt Gingrich and Antonin Scalia. Stick around. No.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program. Your radio support group for We the People.
That we're fighting for, is it still our creed from shore to shore? After a soldier fights, should we read him as new rights? There's not that many to read anymore. Where's all the freedom that we're fighting for?
21 minutes past the hour.
Yeah, good question. Where is that?
it's actually not all that funny. Jeremy Scahill, by the way, has a piece in today's L.A. Times, Blackwater's Bright Future, that is really worth reading. Check it out. Bill Kristol says that, well, in fact, before I get to this, let me share with you Newt Gingrich on TV this weekend. Again, what are the corporate, why did the corporate media give this guy any airtime? I mean, he's disgraced. He's out of office for a long, long time. Americans are over this kind of divisive, angry, hateful, lying politics. And yet here's Newt Gingrich over the weekend on Face the Nation.
This court decision is a disaster, which could cost us a city.
Could cost us a city. Newt, do you know something we don't know? I'm hearing a lot of this rhetoric now from the right. That this, you know, in fact, Scalia, in the decision itself, he said this court decision will cause the death of more Americans. Does that mean that you guys have a false flag operation ready? Or does that mean that there's another one of these things where the president is getting memos saying Bin Laden determined to strike on August or September or October? Is this the kind of deal that your daddy George cut with the Iranians to hold the hostages so that Jimmy Carter would lose the presidency and we'd have the first Republican president in a while? I mean, what's the deal here? So Newt Gingrich saying this could cost us a city.
And the debate ought to be over whether or not you're prepared to risk losing an American city.
See, there it is again.
On behalf of five lawyers. It was a 5-4 decision.
Five lawyers, five Supreme Court justices, Newt, who were vetted by the Senate, who represent one of the three branches of government whose job is to check the powers of the other two.
And five lawyers have decided.
Five lawyers. No, five Supreme Court justices. You could just as easily say five Five guys who wear pants. Actually, one of them is a woman, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. You could easily say five people who ate mashed potatoes. I mean, what is on it? They are justices of the Supreme Court. Well, he's trying to minimize them the same way they try to minimize Democrats by calling them the Democrat Party.
That the Supreme Court counts more than the Congress and the President combined in national security, that has never been true in American history.
And it's not true now. The Supreme Court is not telling the government how to run the national security policy. They're simply saying that when you do run national security policy, whatever you do and however you do it, you can't violate the Constitution. You can't strip out habeas corpus. You just can't.
That ought to be a principled argument between McCain and Obama about whether or not you're prepared to allow any random nutcake district judge who has no knowledge of national security to set the rules for terrorists.
Right. So, number one, district judges are random and nutcases, the majority of them having been appointed by Republicans and many of them being members of the Federalist Society. Maybe he's right. Secondly, and this was the argument that Scalia made in his rebuttal, his response, his dissent in the Supreme Court ruling, was that judges would now be responsible for determining the fate of these detainees. Well, yeah. I mean, for what, 1,000 years or more of common law? I mean, going all the way back to British common law history, it has been judges. That's the whole job of a judge. The judge runs the trial. In the trial, the prosecutors come forward with evidence. The defense comes forward with evidence. The judge runs the trial. The judge or the jury makes the decision. That's the way it's supposed to be, Newt. Somebody needs to let Newt Gingrich know that judges are actually supposed to run trials. And what the Supreme Court said is that if we arrest somebody and throw them in prison, if we arrest you, the listener, you, Newt Gingrich, me, anybody else, if the United States government arrests somebody, the whole point of the Constitution was to limit the power of government, was to say, if this government arrests somebody and says, okay, you know, we're hauling you off, that's it, then that person, then if you are arrested by the Supreme Court, then you have the right to say, prove to me why you think that I should be arrested. That's called habeas corpus. Prove to me that you have some evidence against me. Let me face my accusers in court. Let me have a trial before a judge or jury of my peers. Let me have that trial in a reasonably short time. You know, in England right now, they're fighting over whether they should extend the amount of time that you can hold a, quote, terrorist suspect, end quote, without charging them with a crime from 32 days to 48 days. We've got guys in Guantanamo who've been there 6 years. No charges. And now the McClatchy newspaper is doing this investigation, this very, very, very thorough investigation. And what they have found is absolutely mind-boggling. I mean, they went to several continents, dozens of different countries, interviewed hundreds of people, arguably thousands of people, an 8-month investigation in 11 countries on 3 continents, has found numerous men in the Bagram Air Base, in Guantanamo, in U.S. prisons around the world, and God knows how many of them have been sent off to places like Libya or Egypt to simply be tortured and die. Many of them who actually did die in U.S. detention, who committed no crimes. In fact, many of them were not even our enemies. They were working for us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Newspapers, an investigation, 3 continents, 11 countries, hundreds of people they interviewed, former detainees, guards. Guards say they routinely beat their prisoners to retaliate for Al-Qaeda's 9/11 attacks, unaware that the vast majority of the detainees had little or no connection at all to al-Qaeda. They had no idea. In fact, they opened today's story with, you know, this is absolutely incredible. They opened today's story, McClatchy Newspapers opens today's story with the story of a guy at Bagram, Nazur Shaman Gul. What did this guy do for a living? He worked as a guard for the U.S., guarding a fuel depot in Afghanistan. Unfortunately, he had a guy that he's described as a tribal rival. We don't know what he's a rival for, maybe for another woman, maybe for a goat, maybe for a plot of land, who knows. But some guy who didn't like him turned him in. And this guy ended up at Guantanamo Bay. Why? How did the U.S. come to hold so many farmers and goat herders among the real terrorists at Guantanamo? The majority of the detainees, this is from McClatchy, taken to Guantanamo, came into U.S. custody indirectly. These were not, as Newt Gingrich and all the right-wing bloviators would have you believe, these were not people captured on the field of battle. They were people who were turned in for bounties by locals. Well, here's the story. The majority of the detainees taken to Guantanamo came into U.S. custody indirectly from Afghan troops, warlords, mercenaries, and Pakistani police who often were paid cash by the number and alleged importance of the men they handed over. Because of the bounties advertised in flyers that the U.S. planes dropped all over Afghanistan in late 2001, there was financial incentive for locals to lie about the detainees' background. Only 33% of the former detainees were initially detained by U.S. forces. Only a third. Of those third, they're looking at 22 out of 66. Of those 22, 17 were Afghans who'd been captured around mid-2002 or later as part of the peacekeeping mission in Afghanistan, a fight that had more to do with counterinsurgency than with terrorism. In other words, many of these people, to the extent that they were fighting against us, were simply saying, get the hell out of my town. But the majority of it was about people looking to settle old grudges in Afghanistan. So they've, for example, they've got this guy, Nazar Shaman Gul. He says, I was punched and kicked at Bagram. At Bagram, they took a man to interrogation at night. The next morning, we would see him brought out on a stretcher looking almost dead. He was held there more than 3 months. American soldiers would walk into the pen where he slept on the floor and ram their combat boots into his back and stomach, Gul said. Two or three of them would come in suddenly, tie my hands, and beat me. He's cry out, I'm not a terrorist, and beg God for mercy. He was shipped to Guantanamo in the late summer of 2003 and imprisoned there for 3 more years. He wasn't a member of al-Qaeda. He wasn't a member of the Taliban. He wasn't anything. He was working as a fuel depot guard for the U.S.-based Afghan government. He worked for us. So how did he end up at Guantanamo? A guy he didn't like turned him in and made a quick $1,000. $1,000 being twice the annual income of a person who's actually employed in Afghanistan. I mean, this is how weird and sick and twisted it is, and yet at the same time, to keep this system in place, John McCain and Lindsey Graham, according to Bill Kristol, are about to introduce legislation to get around the Supreme Court ruling. And here's Lindsey Graham talking about that.
And I think you will see Senator Graham, accompanied by Senator McCain, come to the floor of the Senate very soon, like next week, and say, we cannot let chaos obtain here. We can't let 200 different federal district judges on their own whim call this CIA agent here, say, I don't believe this soldier here who said this guy was doing this. You have to release someone, or let's compromise sources and methods with a bunch of trials. I mean, it's ridiculous.
A bunch of trials. It's ridiculous. What? Have due process? Have rule of law in the United States? No, we can't have that. Oh, man. Press in Santa Rosa, California, listening on Green 960. Hey, by the way, our number, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Hey, Press.
Hi, Tom. How are you there?
Good.
Good. Comrade Kristol. Yes. I have a request, a comment, and a quick question, and I'll make very solar. I'll use a lot of speed, okay?
Okay.
That's easy. Okay, the first request I have of you, perhaps, or perhaps some people that are savvy in this area, when they could put an audio tape together of all the people that used the phrase rule of law back when Clinton was being impeached. Kay Bailey Hutchison,
Press, let me toss it back at you. Put together an audio tape. Send it to me. I'll play it. No, it's a great suggestion. It really is. What was your question?
Especially when Bob Barr seems so moderate and peaceful now. You know what I mean? I remember he was the most rabid one.
Yeah.
But he is constituted. The comment I had was, this is perfect. These right-wingers are so arrogant. They give us our own material for us to use.
Yeah.
How about this, Newt? 5 lawyers put Bush in the White House.
There you go. Well said, Press. And in fact, it's true. It's true. But it was 5 Supreme Court justices, and that's why it stuck. You know, the fact that they happen to be lawyers. I mean, it's just, I was astounded that nobody at the network challenged him on his lies, his distortions, his spin, his propaganda. I mean, this is Newt doing propaganda, which he does very well. And nobody challenged him. It was pathetic. James in New Paltz, New York. Hey, James.
Hi, Tom. How's everything?
Just fine.
What's up? Quick comment. You're talking about Homeland Security. You know, this terrible situation that's going on in Iowa. There's a report out. I posted it on one of your websites. The head of the National Guard there said he does not have enough manpower or equipment to properly address that situation.
Right.
So you talk about a threat to our country. There is one going on right now. And one of the facts that we cannot properly deal with it, why isn't that an issue? Why aren't we talking about that?
Well, it's just a piece of the whole. I mean, the whole is that George Bush has sent us off into an invasion of Afghanistan and a subsequent war and Iraq that have weakened our country, that have solidified the position of the radicals. I mean, you know, Osama bin Laden wanted to increase his own fame, which he did. I mean, he only had 20,000 followers. He was pretty much nobody had heard of him before. He wanted to increase his own fame, so George Bush turned him into Lex Luthor. He wanted to bankrupt the United States. We're now running, you know, a war and occupation that over the long term, when you include everything, including the cost of treating our GIs when they get home, it's going to be over $2 trillion, which will bankrupt the United States. It's in the process of it. Our major export now is dollars. If you look at the cost of oil in euros, the cost of gasoline in euros right now, gasoline, if we paid for our oil in euros instead of dollars, our gasoline would be about $2.12 a gallon. And so what we're seeing is the insanity of the Bush fiscal policies, which, again, ties back to his hyper response to bin Laden. Bin Laden wanted to unite the Muslim world, which he has done to a large extent, and at least the radical Muslim world. And bin Laden wanted to get the U.S. Soldiers out of the Air Force bases, out of the Air Force base in Saudi Arabia, because he considered it blasphemous, and Bush pulled them out. Bin Laden has gotten everything he wanted. The United States and George Bush, you know, used this for political power. I mean, there's that famous quote.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
So, George Bush in 1999, that he was going to use the invasion of Iraq to gain political power, which is what he did. Paul in Long Beach, California, listening to K-Talk. Hey, Paul.
Hey, Tom. I'm really glad you're talking about this particular topic about the wrongful imprisonment of many people in Guantanamo Bay. I'm having a big argument with someone on the Internet over this. One thing that I think would be great for me and for lots of your listeners, I know before I got on and heard, you had mentioned the sources of some of the stories, the specific stories about people who were interned there.
McClatchy Newspapers, McClatchy Newspapers, which used to be Knight Ridder, is the only wire service that I know of that is actually doing any serious investigative journalism anymore. And none of the networks are doing it. They've by and large shut down their bureaus. You've got Larissa Alexandrovna out there working for Raw Story. She's doing some great investigative journalism. And McClatchy Newspapers. And that's about it. Tom Lessiter. And these two articles, this is part of a series now. One was published on the 16th today. One was published on the 15th yesterday. and they were in the New York Times. They were, you know, they were picked up by most of the major newspapers around the world.
So they were in places.
Yeah, it's,
like that.
This stuff is easily Googled.
Okay.
Easily found. It's probably printed in your local newspaper today. And if not, you know, pick up the Times or the LA Times, the New York or the Los Angeles Times. So it's around. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. There's a pile of information out there. Thank you, Paul. And it's a brilliant, brilliant investigative journalism. Phil in Tampa. Hey, Phil, just a couple seconds here before this break is going to... Whoop, hang on. I thought I had it. Thought I had 30 seconds more than I did. Phil, stick around. We'll pick you up on the other side of the break. It is 16 minutes, sorry, 45 minutes past the hour. 45 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock on the West Coast, noon on the East Coast, and wherever you are. And it's the Tom Hartman radio program right here on Air America Radio. Stick around. We'll be back.
The Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Before the hour. Yeah, there's no place you can hide. I'm sorry. They're gone. Blackwater's got them all figured out. 70%? Between 50 and 70% of all of our intelligence now is in the hands of private corporations, and we're wondering why we get such bad intelligence that we go into wars that are very profitable for private corporations. Tell me John Cusack's movie, War, Inc., hasn't become reality. A mind-bogglingly good movie, by the way. Phil, and back to Phil in Tampa. My apologies, Phil, for...
Yes, I had the opportunity to visit Normandy,
mm-hmm.
And there was a prison that the French underground were kept in during the occupation of France. They were never given a trial. They were just grabbed and put into this prison indefinitely.
Right.
These are people who were shooting... German officers and others at cafes who were blowing up trains, who were blowing up troops.
Terrorists by any definition.
They were terrorists. Okay? And the only way they got out, unfortunately, the way they got out, so to speak, is during the invasion in Caen. This is where it was. The American bombers bombed the prison and most died that way.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is... that this is the kind of thing that Gingrich and others want us to be able to do. In other words, follow right. The German model.
Right, and McCain is apparently signing on to this just 3 years after he condemned Gitmo and condemned torture and indefinite detentions. He's before it, after he was against it, after he was, you know, who knows what he was.
This goes to the expression that deep inside every conservative is a fascist screaming to get out.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Phil. Well said. Rawl, is it Rawl or Raleigh in Queens? Rawl. Hey, Rawl, what's up?
Nothing much, Tom. I was just listening to some of the opponents of the decision to restore habeas corpus,
mm-hmm.
arguing that Guantanamo Bay is not part of the United States, even though we fly our flag there and control that territory.
Right. That's the basis, by the way, if you read the Supreme Court decision, that's the basis of most of John Roberts' dissent.
Right. And actually, they would be rejecting centuries of diplomatic tradition, whereas where a country plants its flag on foreign soil is that country.
That's
why
right.
They can't come into the embassies because it's considered part of the United States.
That's right.
If they want to make that argument, are they then willing to cede that the Panama Canal Zone is not a U.S. territory and therefore John McCain is not a citizen?
Yeah, and I made that comment on the show last week. Although I think that there's also a provision that if you have two American citizens as parents, pretty much anywhere you are born in the world, even if you're not born on a military base, you're still a U.S. citizen. So, you know, if you and your wife happen to be traveling in France and she has a baby in a French hospital, that baby's still a U.S. citizen, I believe.
Still a U.S. citizen.
Yeah. Okay. He may or may not be able to qualify for dual citizenship with France. Different countries have different rules, but.
Right.
So I don't, you know, it's a nice rhetorical point to make.
Yeah.
But I think the bottom line is that it's not going to affect John McCain. But it kind of rubs it in. It good point, Rollin, and I appreciate your calling and making it. Larry in Baltimore. Hey, Larry.
Yeah, Tom.
Hey, what's up?
Great fan. Love
Thank
the
you.
Show.
Thank you.
Real quick, third party story is that there's emails going around NSA to prepare for massive layoffs should Obama be elected.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Now, is this? I've done contract work for NSA, and I know that, and I've been inside the buildings, and I know that there are a large number of people working in NSA buildings who are not NSA employees; they're independent contractors. Does that mean that? Are you talking about emails that are flying around among the? Again, there's a pretty clear demarcation between the contractors and the employees. I mean, the employees certainly know who the contractors are. Is this the contractors who are concerned about layoffs, or is this the actual employees of NSA?
To be honest, I'm not sure which.
Yeah, I would guess that it's probably the contractors who are getting those kind of emails, because as Jeremy Scahill pointed out, Barack Obama has already sponsored legislation to scale back this practice. So, that would be my guess. Larry, thanks a lot for the call. That's very interesting. And just for the record, you know what? Oh, you worked for the NSA, huh? Yes. Back in the 90s, I was CEO of an ad agency in Atlanta, Chandler, McDonald, Stout, Schneiderman, and Poe. We had a division that did consulting and training, and I did consulting and training work in marketing, advertising, communications, that kind of stuff. The kind of stuff that basically I wrote a book about called Cracking the Code, How to Effectively Communicate, and did consulting work for the NSA. I can't get into the details of it other than to say it had to do with internal communications and communications with NATO countries. And I did consulting work for 5 years in a row for U.S. military intelligence in Germany. And we used to hold public seminars. We trained hundreds of Fortune 500 companies. I remember two guys from the DEA showed up one time. I was standing by the table where they were, you know, these 2-day, $265 weekend seminar kind of things. And these two guys showed up kind of scruffy. This was down in Miami. And said, can we sign up for the seminar? And the woman says, yeah. And this guy pulls this huge wad of $100 bills out of his pocket and starts peeling them off to pay for it. And she says, what agency are you with? What organization? He goes, DEA. I was like, oh, man. So anyway, I've not been a spy. So we'll just leave that at that. Dan in Boston, we just have a few seconds here before we got to wrap up the show. Quick note you wanted to make?
Hey, Tom.
Or at least wrap up this hour.
Yeah, real quick. It's going to come down to our leadership. Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid clearly are not getting the job done. They're never in session on Fridays. They're never in session on Mondays. We need real leadership. That's the only way this is going to happen. And the reason they don't want to do anything about it is next time it could be them. Thanks.
Yeah, it could be, Dan. I'm not quite that cynical. And typically the House is not in session on those days so that members can travel out to their districts, because they view that a good part of their job, and a lot of members of Congress actually do this, is to be in their districts and to hear from their people. So coming up next, Kerry Lucas, should we nationalize
You're
healthcare?
Listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Families USA, the voice for healthcare consumers, has the results of a new study out now. 50-state survey released today reveals that insurance companies in most states are not prohibited from denying health coverage to people with pre-existing conditions. They are not prohibited from refusing to pay for services needed to treat common ailments. And all of this is adding huge premium surcharges for people. Oh, they are not prohibited from adding huge premium surcharges for people with family histories of health problems. And they are not prohibited from yanking policies and denying payments when consumers face a rash of medical bills. In other words, just when you get sick, your insurance company can say, we're not going to take your check anymore, and we're not going to pay anything anymore. Sorry, see you later. In fact, only 5 states prohibit insurance companies from cherry-picking the healthiest consumers and excluding everyone else. Only 35 states and districts in Columbia, there are no limits on how much an insurer can raise your premium based on your health status. Boom, you get cancer suddenly in 35 states of the United States. You get cancer, all of a sudden you're paying $5, $10, $15, $20,000 a month for health insurance. In 21 states in the District of Columbia, insurers can exclude coverage for pre-existing conditions for more than a year. In 44 states in the District of Columbia, insurers can revoke an individual's health insurance policy without advance review by the state. In other words, they can simply say, oh, you got sick? We're not going to insure you anymore. That's 44 states. 29 states in the District of Columbia, insurers are allowed to deny legitimate claims of policyholders who are up to date with their premium payments by digging back years into their medical history and alleging that they failed to disclose or should have known about a pre-existing condition. Well, you have cancer, and you never noticed that you were feeling a little tired? We think that's a pre-existing condition. 45 states of the District of Columbia, insurers do not have to spend at least 75% of premium revenue on health care. In other words, they can take even more than 25% of all the money that they get in and spend it on things like executive compensation, so people like Bill McGuire can make more than $1.7 billion. And in 20 states and the District of Columbia, insurers can set and raise premiums anytime they want for any reason they want because there's no meaningful oversight. Carrie Lucas is with us. She's the Vice President of Policy and Economics at the Independent Women's Forum. Carrie, our question, will deregulating the healthcare industry turn into the Wild Wild West? Sounds to me like it's already pretty well deregulated.
I think you're listing a whole lot of regulations that don't exist. And what the study that you're talking about, it doesn't talk about how much these things are going on. So when they talk about the ability of people to, or ability of an insurance company to go ahead and drop someone from coverage the second they get cancer, they don't talk about exactly how much this is happening. So this is really more of a warning story. And I think that one of the
But do you want to have your insurance company have the legal ability to just blow you off, even though you've been making payments for years and years? Because all of a sudden, God forbid, you got cancer.
I do think that it makes sense to look at how what regulations are out there and how to protect people who have been paying in so that an insurance company has to act like an insurance company.
So you're in favor of government regulation of insurance companies?
Some government regulations are prudent and make sense. In particular, when it comes to one of the problems is that we don't have a deregulated healthcare system, and there's a lot of problems. It makes it hard on consumers and hard on insurers, for that matter, to provide products that make sense when it comes to healthcare. You know, one of the things that's not talked about, but I think is really kind of central to when we're talking about the private insurance or individual insurance marketplace, is just how completely unfair it is. The government policy that right now absolutely favors those who have employer provided healthcare. That's really the one of the worst things going in the insurance market, because if you're out there and you're buying individual insurance, you have to do it with after tax dollars. You've already paid taxes on this money, and then you have to go out and buy your health insurance simply because you're not employed by somebody who offers you insurance. But for all those folks who are sitting there and working for big corporations that provide very cushy or very generous health insurance packages, they're all doing that with pre-tax dollars. So that's a really unlevel playing field. So I think we should all
I agree.
Yeah, that's one of the first places to start.
I mean, that's something that should have been done a couple of decades ago, and it's something that, frankly, Democrats have been advocating for and Republicans have been opposing.
Really? I know that the president came out for that earlier and talked about the need to try to level this playing field so that private insurance was deductible, and I thought that it didn't get much traction on Capitol Hill, but hey, this could be a bipartisan moment, and
well,
we should all jump
was on this board. Was this during the Republican, when the Republicans controlled the House and the Senate? Because I remember writing about this like 6 years ago, and the take then was that folks like Greenspan and the traditional kind of corporate conservatives were opposed to this because they felt that if people could get health insurance anywhere they went more easily, if they didn't have, if they didn't have to get it from their employer, if there was a penalty if they lost their employer, then they would be more likely to leave their employers, and it would stir up the job market.
Gosh, I sure don't think so. As far as, you know, all the groups I talk to and work with, from the Cato Institute and Heritage Foundation, this is one of the top to-do lists, is to change the tax, the tax treatment, so that individual insurance, like employer-provided health insurance, is deductible. So I think that, you know, maybe there is more bipartisanship. I think that
perhaps. On the other hand, you know, what you're suggesting, that if you or I as individuals were to buy health insurance, that it's tax-deductible, just like a corporation, that then becomes the camel's nose under the tent towards saying, we're not going to do any employer-provided health insurance anymore. You're all on your own now. And by the way, isn't it cool that you get a tax break?
Well, but I think that, I don't know.
Is
that so bad? If, you know, one of the real problems that's facing our employment, our healthcare system, and our, frankly, our job market, is that there's a lot of people who feel tied to their jobs because of their health insurance.
Okay, so we're both agreeing that employer-provided health insurance is imperfect.
Absolutely.
Okay, so then the question becomes, why have corporations, private companies, that are taking anywhere from 15% to 30% of our healthcare dollars, of our insurance dollars, and using them to pay huge salaries, to pay bloated bureaucracies, to pay for gold-plated faucets on the corporate jet's bathroom, to pay for advertising and marketing campaigns, to pay for dividends to stockholders, and to pay hundreds of millions of dollars in lobbying, instead of, for example, Medicare, which has a 3% overhead? Why should we turn our health care dollars over to these companies rather than to Medicare? Why not go to a single-payer health care system and call it Medicare?
Well, I bet a lot of people in the audience know instinctively what a problem it would be for the government to take over all of our health care system. One of the problems.
Well, they're running two of the largest health care systems in the country, Medicare and the Veterans Administration.
Yeah, and I think if you ask a lot of people in the Medicaid and Medicare system for that matter, a lot of them express a great deal of frustration, lack of doctor choice, just lack of quality of care. And one of the
problems, nothing compared to not being insured.
Compared to, you know, when we think about things that work well and things that don't work well, one of the main, factors is often an incentive, is competition. And the simple fact is that too often when you have a monopoly or a one party or one provider system, they don't have an incentive to take care of their customers.
Well, I'm not suggesting we make private insurance illegal. I mean, there's always going to be people who have high incomes who are going to want, you know, better, faster, cooler health care than anybody else gets. And there's always going to be a market of people to provide it to them. But, you know, isn't it obscene, frankly, that we have millions and millions of that 50%, more than 50% of all bankruptcies in this country are caused by people getting sick?
Well, sure, and I think that's why we need to make it easier for people to buy insurance. You know, right now, some of the things that make
out of their own pockets.
Out of their own pockets, or you know,
but that's not spreading the risk around. I mean, a single family can't handle that. I mean, the whole point of insurance is to spread the risk. You get as many people involved as possible.
Well, sure, but if we had if our individual insurance, it shouldn't be our health insurance should not be as expensive as it is right now. There's a lot of regulations so that in some states you have to, the individual health insurance you buy or the health insurance you buy has to include mental health care. And while you may decide that that's something you want, I may decide that's something I want. We all know you're going to pay more. Your premiums are going to go up if it provides for things like mental health care. And so that's one of the reasons why I think that we should deregulate, encourage there to be a more choice when it comes to insurance packages so that people can have things like high deductible.
So people can choose to be underinsured.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. You know, basically. And I think that
you don't think that there's going to be a harm to society in that when those underinsured people get hit with a $500,000 health care bill that they can't pay?
Yeah, there is, but there's also a great cost to moving towards a single payer system. If you look at what goes on in Canada, one of the things we should both kind of admit when we're talking about the healthcare system is there's not going to be a perfect system. There's going to be some winners and some losers from any system you create, whether that's government shortages or a few people who can't get healthcare because it's too expensive.
I'll agree with you on that. Absolutely. Carrie Lucas, Vice President of Policy and Economics at the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org is their website. Carrie, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you.
16 minutes past the hour.
This is Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news.
Out in Taiwan, my gallbladder out in Greece. Took a side trip up to Sweden to fill some caverns in my teeth. Saw a doctor down in Denmark and a specialist in Spain to see what could be causing me this dull but steady pain. Took a trip up to Toronto just to buy some little pills. Thought I'd died and gone to heaven when they handed me the bill. Went to Norway when I noticed that my eardrum had a hole. Got back home just in time to watch the Super Bowl. It's been a brutal year, but man, I'm glad I was overseas, where you can see the doctor when you really got a need. Where people, they live longer, babies also like they should. I guess they call it healthcare, and I guess they got it good.
I guess this thing called healthcare, how strange it is. Well, you know, the fundamental difference between John McCain and Barack Obama on these issues, in my opinion, boils down to this deep philosophical difference between the role of government in these things. And, well, for example, you know, Ronald Reagan, famous for saying,
I've always felt the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Yeah. And you know, 1981, Reagan being sworn into office, ushered in an era which has, by and large, extended right to this day. You'll recall it was Bill Clinton who said the era of big government is over. It was Bill Clinton who aggressively actually shrunk the size of government, the number of employees, although the number of contractors went up. I mean, it's flip a coin. But nonetheless, it was Bill Clinton who gave us balanced budgets. But Reagan, I would say Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Bush have all had basically the philosophy that the role of government should be highly limited, highly restricted, and that most things are solved best by the free market. And if you're talking about consumer goods, I absolutely agree. I don't want the government making my TV set. I don't want them making my computer. I don't want them making my shoes. I don't want them making my blue jeans. I don't want them making my car. When I lived in Germany, the little East German cars, the Trebbies, they were a disaster. Government-manufactured cars, little three-cylinder things that left a huge cloud of smoke behind them wherever they went and weren't upgraded for decades. And, you know, you could get them in one color. And it's just, I think they had multiple colors for them. But in any case, I don't want the government engaged in those things. But the one reason why we have government, and this is why it blows my mind that we don't even have civics classes of any consequence in our high schools anymore, because you've got kids graduating from school who obviously don't even know why we created the United States of America in the first place. They think it was about getting rid of taxes. In fact, the whole tax thing had to do with, you know, the British East India Company getting a tax break on their tea. The no taxation without representation, as it tied into the Boston Tea Party, was the colonist objecting to a tax break for a big corporation while taxes were still being hit at fairly high levels on their small entrepreneurial import shops. So, you know, it was an objection to Walmart, as it were. But nonetheless, the split, I would say, breaks down to Obama is taking the position, or a position very close to the position, that health care in the United States is a right, and that it falls broadly under the rights defined in the Constitution, or the Declaration of Independence anyway, the preamble of the Constitution as well. In the preamble of the Constitution, the references to the general welfare. In the Declaration of Independence, the word is happiness, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But here's the opening sentence of the Constitution, what it says, why we created this country. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice. Tell people who could be disappeared by the president about that one. ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Doesn't say anything about Iraq in there. Do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. So, broadly speaking, the people have the right, under the welfare clause or the welfare reference in the preamble of the Constitution, have a right to health care, that health care should be a right. John McCain is taking the contrary position, the classic Republican conservative position, that no, health care is a privilege, that whether you live or die is a privilege. There is no right to life in the United States, according to John McCain and the Republican Party, and some Democrats for that matter. There is no right to life. If you are sick, for actual living, breathing humans, if you are sick and you may die and you don't have the money to solve that problem, see you later, Charlie. That's the bottom line from the Republican point of view. You know, and if you chose to get a high-risk insurance, health insurance policy, or if you chose to be underinsured, hey, it was your choice. That's the Republican point of view. The Democratic point of view is and has been ever since Harry Truman proposed national health care in 1947 and couldn't get it through a Republican legislature. The Republicans controlled the House and the Senate that year. The Democratic position has always been that health care is a right. It's been more or less explicit by various people at various times, but that's the bottom line. And I think we really need to frame the debate in those terms. Is health care a right or a privilege? And if it's a right, then our government has the obligation to protect our rights or to provide for our rights, protect our life, our right of life, and our right, and through the general welfare clause. It's absolute.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Good plan. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com and click chat up at the top. Or you can find a link off AirAmerica.com/Tom Hartman page. You can find all the information there. And you'll also find links to the Tom Hartman page and on Air America to our Tom Vision. We're webcasting the shows now. Frank in Fort Lauderdale, listening on WINS. Hey, Frank, what's on your mind today?
Good afternoon, Tom. I was just wondering, I listen to you regularly, and I heard about the fact that as far as a government auto industry, you wouldn't be in favor of it with your experiences in the past. And I would believe that if you don't want the government making the decisions for you as far as what type of car you drive, why do you think they would do a good job at decisions on health care? I don't quite understand that.
Because with regard to a car, I may have, 15 different preferences, 15 different needs. You know, some people want big cars, some people want small cars. There's a whole, it's a consumer product. It doesn't have to do with my ability to survive, my life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I do want the government regulating the auto industry. I want them to tell me, I want to know that my car is not going to blow up, turn into a fireball if it gets rear-ended. I mean, this is what Ralph Nader brought us. I want the government to tell the car companies that their cars have to get a certain minimum gas mileage. There is a role for government in the marketplace. I want to know that the toys that I buy for my children bought for my kids back in the days when they used toys, were not contaminated with lead. Things like that. I mean, there is a reasonable role for government in the private industry. But when we're talking about the commons, Frank, when we're talking about the things that we all collectively own, and particularly the risks that we all collectively share, those commons, whether it's our water, whether it's our air, I would argue our power, more than half the power in the United States is provided by publicly owned utilities. I think it should be all. They are, in almost all cases, more efficient and deliver electricity at a lower cost because you don't have stockholders basically skimming the profits off the top. And I would submit to you that health care is part of the commons, that there are such large risks. You get sick, you get injured, you break your neck, and you're paralyzed for the rest of your life. We're talking about hundreds of thousands to tens of millions of dollars in terms of the cost of care over a lifetime. Such huge risks that it's absolutely unreasonable to assume that one person can bear those risks, or to ask one family or even one extended family or even one neighborhood or community to bear those risks. We have to do that collectively on the largest scale possible, which minimizes the risk for all of us individually.
Well, you have to understand, though, Tom, our government has two powers. If me and you were farmers and the government wanted us to grow wheat, what they would do is they would subsidize us. If they did not
necessarily
grow corn, well, the government has two powers: the power to tax and the power to subsidize. We should be subsidizing what we want. We should be taxing what we don't want. And unfortunately, in a socialist type mentality, what you end up doing is you end up taxing people who are innovative and hardworking. And you tend to subsidize people who are happy doing and performing at bare minimums. And you cannot.
Well, if that's the case, Frank, why is it that when you go into a state-of-the-art hospital, the really coolest equipment is all made outside the United States in countries that have what you would call socialist healthcare systems?
Well, as a matter of fact, Tom, I am in the healthcare community, and I can tell you, I work in the cardiac field. I can tell you, in South Florida, we get Canadians come down here who are on 6-month waiting lists for cardiac catheterizations. They come down here and they walk into a hospital and have the procedure. I also go to school with guys who do the exact same job I do all over the United States, in North and South America. I was at dinner with a gentleman who does the exact same job at me from Canada. Okay? I'm an engineer. His tax rate is at 51%.
And
Tom, I don't want to pay 51 cents on a dollar to have a health care.
Consider something for a second, Frank. Consider something for a moment,
sir.
Frank. Do you mind telling me how much money you make a year?
Do you disagree with what I'm saying?
I'm just going to extend this for a moment. If you don't want to tell me how much you make in a year, let's just pick a number. Let's just say Frank makes $70,000 a year, okay? Just for the hell of it, just for the purpose of discussion, because I want to talk about taxes with you for a second around this, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Let's just imagine that you make $70,000 a year. You're paying 50% tax. That means that you're walking home with $45,000 a year, right?
No, what? Sir. That means you're making you're coming home with $35,000.
Thirty-five out of 70. You're right.
Paying a mortgage bill. If you've got a $200,000 house on a 30-year fixed mortgage.
Now, just stay with me for a second here, Frank. Just stay with me for a second.
Let me rebut what you say. Go ahead.
Sure. Yeah. Let's say you're making 70 and you're taking home 35. You're paying a 50% tax. What that means is that your employer knows that you're willing to work for $35,000 at the end of the day, right?
If you stayed at that job or stayed in that country, I guess so.
Yeah. And employers understand that there's a market for employees, and the market for employees really has nothing to do with taxes. It has to do with how much money people have at the end of the day, after taxes. So your employer knows that you're willing to work for $35,000 a year. Now, let's say that you're living in Canada and paying 50% income tax, and all of a sudden George Bush takes over Canada and cuts taxes down to 20%. And so you're still making $70,000 a year, but now instead of taking home $35,000 a year, you're taking home, and apparently you can do math in your head faster than me, you're taking home something like $50,000 a year, right?
That's correct.
What's your employer going to do? They know that you'll do that job for $35,000 a year. Do you think that they're going to continue paying you $70,000?
Well, what you're doing there is you're building a straw man and you're not going to.
No, I'm not, because look at the last 7 years. George Bush cuts taxes, and what happens? Pay goes down. Look at the 8 years that preceded that. Bill Clinton increased taxes, and what happened? Pay went up. The bottom line is the marketplace will always compensate for taxes. That's why in Sweden, with 50%, 55% tax rates, people are making enough money to live. And that's why in the United States, with 25% tax rates or 30%, 32% maximum, people are making enough to live. The bottom line is it doesn't matter. You say, oh, my God, they're paying 51% tax rate, but they don't have to pay for health care.
Okay, well, out of that $35,000, Tom, if you've got a $200,000 30-year mortgage, you're paying $2,000 a month on a mortgage payment with taxes and insurances. That's $24,000 a year. So on that $70,000 income, you got $35,000 left after taxes. After you pay your $200,000 mortgage payment for the year, you can subtract $24,000 from $35,000. So you have
You're living on 11 grand. No, I understand, Frank. I totally understand. My point is that whether the taxes go up or down over the short term, over 1 year, yeah, you're going to notice a difference. But you average that over a five-year period, and I defy you to find any time in the history of the United States, and I've looked at 200 years of these numbers, any time in the history of the United States when this has not been the case, over a five-year period, it will eventually average out. What you will find is that the labor market is always defined by after-tax revenue, after-tax income.
At the Carter administration, Tom. That's all you got. In going, I've got to go. One last question, Tom.
Yeah.
Does anybody know whether or not Randy Rhodes...
Marzina in Toronto, Canada. Hey, Marzina.
Hi. Hi.
My apologies for Frank's...
that's okay. Am I on the air right now?
You are. Welcome to our program.
Okay. You're welcome. Listen, I called because I was listening to the interview you were having with the lady about healthcare, just previous lady that you were interviewing. And she said something, and I just wrote this down. She says, if you look at what's going on in Canada, and that got to me. Because I've heard that opinions many times on your radio, people would call, and against the health insurance in Canada.
And you're listening to us from Toronto, Canada.
Yeah, I'm calling from Toronto, Canada. Mm-hmm. I've lived in Canada for 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
So she says something like that, and I go, okay, where those statistics are coming from? What do people know that I don't know that I...
Marzina, we just have a minute before we've got to take a break. Are you saying that you like or even love the health care that you get in Canada?
Of course.
Why?
Of course. It's the main reason is that, you know what, I've been hospitalized many times. Well, not many, some. I have a child who had some problems. I go to doctor every year for checkups. My son goes for checkups. I never, ever in my life had a thought cross my mind how I'm going to pay for it.
Yeah.
You know, that's the main thing. Ever, never. There is a problem. You call your doctor.
Now, what about having to wait 6 months to get a cardiac catheterization or something?
I've never heard of such a thing. Yeah. I had some problems, and I had surgeries right away, checkups right away. And I live in a big city. I live in Toronto, where a couple of million people still live.
Interesting. So there's a lot of competition for it. Marzina, thank you very much for the call.
Yeah.
And thanks for listening to us there in Toronto. I appreciate it. 866-303-2270, TomHartmann.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, the status of healthcare, and the news of the day, coming up next.
Tom Hartmann.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Still last 10 years like they should. The best of the free life behind. behind us now. The good time's really over for good.
Stop rolling downhill like a snowball headed for hell.
Sing it with me.
Stand up for the flag and let's all ring the liberty bell.
You tell them, Willie.
Let's make a Ford and a Chevy that would still last 10 years like the should.
I think they're starting to.
Cause the best of the free life is still yet to come. The good times ain't over for good.
There you go. 51 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Show. David in Portland, Oregon. Hey, David, what's on your mind?
I think I want to agree with your previous caller about what was said in passing at the end of that conversation you had with that woman from the Independent Women's Group.
Yeah.
I know lots of Canadians, and I've never heard any complaints whatsoever. In fact, they talk about how good their health care is, and they don't understand why we don't get on board.
Yeah, I my experience has been the same, David. I do know a lot of Canadians, and I have yet to hear the complaints. I don't get it. John in Miami. In fact, our producer is a Canadian, Sean Taylor. John in Miami. Hey, John.
Hi, how you doing?
Just great. What's up?
Here you go. Listen, I just wanted to suggest something when it comes to talking to people about the health care issue, specifically talking to consumers and trying to help them to see the light. A lot of them just have an instinctive, just visceral reaction to the idea of saying that health care is a right. It goes against their worldview.
Yeah.
Just like if you go by the Lackoff theories, you know, they're...
Yeah. John, your phone is breaking up really badly, if you can make your point.
Well, here's the thing. If you call it a right, it gets their backup. But if you say that it is something that the government can rightfully provides or justly provides to help us to secure our rights to life and property and liberty and so forth, such as just as it provides police service or fire service and things like that, I've had it. That worked successfully. And
yeah, that, it makes a lot of sense, John. And in fact, we did a show here on the privatization of fire departments. There was a time in the United States when we had private fire departments, and it didn't work out all that well. And that's a great example of sharing the risk. It's a very good example, in fact. Mickey, a pharmacist in San Francisco, listening on Green 960. Hey, Mickey.
Hi, Tim.
Tom.
Tom.
Okay.
Well, speaking of Tim, before I say anything, I just got to say, with Tim Russert's passing, I really appreciate your thoughtful conversation with America.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. We're all going to miss him. There are a lot of things about Tim Russert, a lot of his, a lot of things I disagreed with and a lot of things I agreed with. But by and large, at the bottom line, he was, to all accounts, a very decent guy. So.
One of the things I wanted to say is, as a pharmacist dealing with a specialized disease state like HIV, I can't tell you how many times I can tell you how many times I've heard somebody pleased with their insurance.
Mm-hmm.
None.
Yeah.
Anybody who's pleased with their insurance is healthy and they don't know any better.
I can tell you, I have pretty decent health care and have. Thank God for most of my life, I've had an income that has allowed me to have the top end policy that is available. And now, even with that, right now, if I go to see the doctor, or I have lab tests or whatever, and you do this on a regular basis. I don't have any particular health problem that I'm complaining about other than having had pneumonia when I came back from Africa a while ago. Well, that's case in point. I came back from Africa with pneumonia. And first of all, I tried to get a doctor's appointment. They said, come back in a week. And I'm like, I got a fever of 103. I'm barfing so bad I can hardly move. I'm coughing so bad I think I've broken two ribs. I think I have pneumonia. Go to an ER then. And it's like, no, I just need antibiotics.
why is your doctor, why is your pharmacist, why are they all busy? Because they're spending half of their time filling out forms for companies.
That's right.
We're not providing health care anymore. We're filling out forms. And the difficulty is that with all of the different insurance companies, there's 100 different forms, 1,000 different rules.
Right.
You deal with a company like Blue Cross, and you call one number, you're talking to somebody else, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing.
Right, and from the consumer's point of view, it's even worse. I mean, after I finally, actually I went to ZoomCare, which is a local dock-in-the-box, you know, we'll see you within 15 minutes thing, ZoomCare.com on the web. It's just for Portland, but it's really a cool idea. And the doctor saw me in 15 minutes. He gave me a prescription for the antibiotics, and within 6 hours, my fever was down, and I was, you know, I was getting better. But when the bill was submitted to the insurance company sent us, about 2 weeks later, sent us a copy of the bill saying, if you don't, and a form to fill out, and said, if you don't fill out this form and send it back to us within 15 days, we will not pay the bill. And I'm sure that what they found is that if they send those things out to 100% of their customers, 10, 20% of their customers are on vacation, they don't get around to it, they think it's junk mail and throw it away.
Or what they do is they pile you, they send you, if you've got a serious medical condition, they send you, you'll get mail practically every other day. So they overwhelm
right.
you, like the Reagan administration used to do to investigations. They just throw everything at you to
yeah.
the point where you're overwhelmed and you can't see it.
Right.
And here's my argument for healthcare reform that maybe the Republicans might be able to get on board with. And that is that it's not really been talked about, which is the larger cost of the healthcare system. They're always talking about, oh, well, you know, the baby doctors, they can't treat the women they love. What was that quote from
yeah,
Bush?
George Bush, yeah.
yeah. Well, here's the thing. If healthcare was part of our culture and our society, everything would be paid for. There wouldn't be any need for large liability policies anymore.
Right.
The cost of your automobile insurance, your home insurance, all of those issues would be drastically reduced as well.
Yeah, good point, Mickey. And your healthcare costs would be cut dramatically, because we know that, you know, 15 to 30% of all healthcare dollars are just going into the pockets of CEOs and stockholders.
Tom Hartman.
Helping you win the water cooler wars.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, you see the wackiest things on TV. What is the true state of our economy? Where are we going in America? Are Americans better off than they were 8 years ago? Well, actually 7 years ago, but it'll be 8 years in January. Actually, according to my Bush backwards clock, that Tom Dwyer, the famous Tom Dwyer Automotive here in town, automotive repairers, gave me. And Tom, the battery's starting to wear out in this thing. That's how long it's been. The Bush has been in office that we didn't expect. We thought he'd be impeached long before this. 217 days, 10 hours, 44 minutes, 23 seconds. Pardon my sneeze. That's what happens when you mention Bush around me. I'd say, uh-oh, there it goes. Anyway, are Americans better off today than they were 8 years ago? Are you? Interesting question that got brought up on this week, ABC This Week. And USA Today Gallup poll, of course, released earlier this month. 55% of Americans say, no, we're not better off. And this isn't a matter of, you know, do you think you're better off? Do you feel? Actually, you know, looking at the numbers, are you better off or not? So there was a bit of a conversation about this, shall we say, on ABC This Week.
Separate economic security from national security. This is why I find John McCain's position so interesting, because he wants to and needs to separate himself from Bush, a failed presidency.
First, we have, Mr. Reich.
If you look at the polls, and yet on Iraq and on the economy, he is going beyond what George Bush has done. I mean, his tax cuts are beyond anything that, particularly for the wealthy, beyond.
This is Robert Reich attacking John McCain, basically saying, you know, huge tax cuts, and he's Bush on steroids. He's not just running for the third term of the Bush administration. He's running for the third term of the Bush administration on steroids.
Anything that that George Bush has proposed or did implement.
But Bob, today we have a
And now we have George Will, the voice of sanity and wisdom on the Reich.
Bifurcated economy. The export sector is doing wonderfully. It's pulling the country along. And the Democratic Party is raising doubts about its commitment, indeed it's affirming its lack of commitment, to free trade.
Now, hang on just a second here. The exports part of our economy is pulling the country along. Do you know what we're exporting? We're exporting lumber. We're exporting trash. We're exporting, actually, minerals. We're exporting gold. We're exporting copper. We're exporting, raw materials. We have gone from a nation whose primary exports were finished manufactured goods. The year that Ronald Reagan came into office, we were the largest exporter of finished goods in the world, to a country that exports now raw materials and dollars. The other principal export that we have, look at it in terms of dollars. Our major export right now is debt. It's treasury bonds. It's dollars, dollar-denominated debt. So what's happening all around the world? People are taking our trash, and they're taking our raw materials, and they're taking our debt. They're sitting on these dollars, and they're saying, okay, I got all these dollars. What am I going to do with them? Where can I spend them? Well, I think I'll buy the Chrysler Building in Manhattan. I think I'll buy an American company. Here we have over 14,000 American companies, good, high quality, large, trillions of dollars, almost $2 trillion worth of companies sold to foreign interests since Reagan came into office because of these insane, unsustainable policies. Sorry, George, we are not exporting the way the Chinese are, the way the Japanese are, the way the Taiwanese are, the way that we used to. We're not exporting the fruit of our labors. In other words, we're not exporting things that have added value. I mean, we are to some small extent. We do have some small export industries. And to the extent that the dollar continues to crash, you're going to see more of that because we become more competitive with the other advanced economies like Europe, for example, but just in terms of dollars. But without any kind of a rational trade policy, and we don't have one, our exports are basically dollars and junk. So, anyhow, George Will continues.
Now, it is true that I think there's a disjunction in the public mind without precedent in 200 years of American history.
Without precedent in 200 years of American history? There's a disjunction in the American mind? What could it be?
We have always assumed that the very process, dynamic market capitalism, that produces increased national wealth, simultaneously produced increased family and individual security.
Oh, really? We always assumed that? That free market capitalism would produce increased security for the family. If we always assumed that, then why is it during the Roosevelt administration, Roosevelt said that, let's try Teddy, the Republican, Teddy Roosevelt, in one of his addresses, it was a barn burner. I reprinted a good chunk of the speech in my book, Unequal Protection, the one that Ralph Nader is so fond of. And in this speech, Teddy Roosevelt says, the small businessman is the backbone of America. The medium-sized businessman is a pillar of his community. Now let me speak about the big businessman. This is the risk to America. I mean, that's what we saw. Franklin Roosevelt came along and said, no, we are going to place restrictions on this. Back in the 1880s, Senator Taft and Senator Hartley, Senator Taft from Ohio, Senator Sherman and Senator Taft putting forward the Sherman antitrust bill that said, no, you can't have, a single company having a monopoly in all the software in a computer. You can't have a single company having or even a small number of companies having a monopoly in the oil industry. You can't have a small number of companies having a monopoly in transportation or fill in the blank. Of course, we're there now because Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act. But for a long time, George, we have not bought that right-wing rhetoric. Sorry. Not at all. But anyhow, George Will,
The Democratic Party is raising doubts about its commitment, indeed it's affirming its lack of commitment, to free trade. Now, it is true that I think there's a disjunction in the public mind without precedent in 200 years of American history. We have always assumed that the very process, dynamic market capitalism, that produces increased national wealth, simultaneously produced increased family and individual security.
No,
the doubt is that today's capitalism on steroids, if you will, globalized capitalism, increases national wealth but undermines family and individual security, which will produce a great flinch from free economics.
That's exactly the point. That's exactly the
This is now Robert Reich says, yeah, that's the point, that people don't trust it. They don't believe it.
Problem, George. Americans now have lost their faith in free trade. They've lost their faith in economic growth because they haven't seen the benefits of it. It's all gone to the top.
And here's where George Will goes off the rails. This is where George Will must have had three martinis for lunch before he came on the show.
That's why Obama's tax cuts for the middle class and for the poor are so critical to the campaign.
Because friends like you are misinforming the country by saying that they have not seen benefits. Even housing, Bob. Housing today, after the big decline, the average American house is worth a third more than it was in 2000.
George Will, you tell average Americans that they are better off today than they were in 2000 or 2001, and they will not believe you.
They are not. I will. They are. No! No! Are you better off than you were in 2000, 2001? I don't think so. I mean, talk about a disconnect. Talk about a huge disconnect. And the questions, the real issues are not being addressed. The real issues, like, we're $9 trillion in debt. $30,000 for every single man, woman, and child in the United States. Over $100,000 per family of debt that we owe Saudi Arabia and China and the Bush family, because they own some of our debt as well. That our trade policies are, well, let's borrow money from China so that we can buy things from China. Now, what's the result of that? Well, you get to buy cheap stuff from China, and China ends up with a bunch of dollars. And they use those dollars to do what? To buy us, to buy our companies, to buy our businesses, to compete with us, to build a military that will compete with us militarily, to build an industrial infrastructure that will compete with us in industry. We have become the definition of a third world country. As I said before, we used to be the number one creditor to the nation. When Reagan came into office, we were the world's number one creditor. More countries owed us money than any other country in the world. Today, we're the number one debtor in the history of the world. We used to be the largest manufacturer of exported goods in the world. We beat Japan, we beat Germany, we beat everybody when Reagan came into office. Today, we, instead of being the largest exporter of manufactured goods, we are the largest importer of manufactured goods in the world. We are now a third world country. It's just a matter of time before we figure it out. And this is why I said early in the last hour, if you were to denominate gasoline, U.S. gasoline, in euros instead of dollars, we're paying $2.15 a gallon for it right now, based on how the dollars collapsed against the euro.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
There once was a musical troupe, a pickin' singin' folk group. They sang the mountain ballads and the folk songs of our land. They were long on musical ability. Folks thought they would go far, but political incompatibility led to their downfall. Well, the one on the right was on the left, and the one in the middle was on the right, and the one on the left was in the middle, and the guy in the rear was a Methodist.
Welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Well, time for another Berlusconi alert. Oh, Silvio, you're a never-ending source of entertainment to us. Or is it terror to your own people? Silvio Berlusconi, here's this guy. He's a small-time crook and businessman in Italy. And he buys a radio station, and then he buys a TV station, and then he buys a newspaper, and then he buys another radio station, and then another radio station, and then another TV station, and pretty soon he buys a radio network, and then he buys a TV network, and then he buys another radio network, and then another TV network, and pretty soon he owns all the radio networks and all the TV networks, and most of the newspapers in Italy.
except for the state-owned, you know, their equivalent of NPR. That's his great enemy. And then he runs for prime minister. Gee, and what a surprise he wins. He wins two terms. Then he got kind of bounced out for one term after he got busted for corruption. And now he's back. And he's back with some very strange policies. You wonder if this is inspired by his lunch with George W. Bush 2 days ago. This story by Nick Pisa in The Scotsman. Soldiers are to be deployed in Italian cities as Silvio Berlusconi, the prime minister, cracks down his crime as part of his government's new security domestic security package. Yeah, Mussolini would have loved this. The troops, drawn from those who have served abroad, will patrol alongside regular state police and Carabinieri paramilitary police. Defense Minister Ignacio La Russa said, "We are talking about a contingent of 2,500 troops who will patrol alongside ordinary police. Opposition MPs and police unions do not share their enthusiasm. They say troops on the streets are only seen in places like Bogota, Colombia, against terrorists and armed insurrectionists. The idea of militarizing cities gives an impression of insecurity and will affect tourism and the economy." Berlusconi, though, is not backing down. In fact, he's going to expand his guys with guns, with AK-47s, guys back from Afghanistan and Iraq. He's going to expand the role of them to Rome, Milan, Naples, Florence, Genoa, Bologna. Is that how you pronounce it? Bologna? Bologna? Turin, Palermo, Bari, and Venice. Good old Silvio. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And, oh my, let's see here. Patty in Columbus, Ohio, you want to pick up on the insurance theme of the last hour. Hey, Patty.
Excuse me?
Hi, you are on the air.
Oh, hi. I did want to talk about the interview where the woman was talking about buying health insurance. This makes me furious whenever I hear this, and I heard John McCain talking about a tax credit for buying health insurance. The point that they leave out is that only healthy people can buy health insurance. I tried for several years. My partner could not be covered under my insurance at the employer that I had, but she had a pre-existing heart condition.
Ouch.
And I would repeatedly send $2,000 and $3,000 premiums, the startup money, and then a nurse comes to your house and takes your health history, and they would kindly send my money back.
Yep.
And
it's called cherry picking in the industry.
And no one ever addresses how people who have ever been sick. In fact, I think probably John McCain could not buy insurance for himself if he wanted.
No, he couldn't.
Would address the idea of the pre-existing condition. It doesn't matter if you make a good living. We had the money to buy health insurance. No one would take our money to buy health insurance.
Yeah.
And I never hear anyone address that piece when they talk about tax credits for buying health insurance or all these options for buying health insurance.
Yeah. Now, this whole free market thing is nuts. Patty, thank you very much. Very well said. I mean, it is plain old flat out crazy to assume that the health insurance companies are all of a sudden going to start behaving against their own best interests simply because John McCain gave each one of us an extra $5,000 in tax rebates so that we could buy health insurance. I'm not buying it. Patricia in L.A., we got a minute before the break. Patricia, what's up?
Yes. Yes, thank you for taking the call. Preventative health, you know, public paid, you know, government paid preventative health care insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Let the drug companies continue to have health insurance to cover drug care, surgery to cover surgery care,
mm-hmm.
but government paid preventative health care for the public, including everything that means, you know, education on real food, nutrition,
annual checkups, mammograms, PAP screening, heart screening, all that kind of stuff. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, but teaching people how to care for themselves, giving them the real
right.
deal. It's not about drugs and surgery. It's about how to take care of yourself, how to stay well.
Yeah, that was the point Dr. Louis Malmadrona made in our program a couple weeks ago, my friend who's a professor of medicine up in Canada. And he said, you know, so much of our illness is absolutely preventable. And or it could be caught very early. And the big problem in the United States, it's not a problem in Canada, but the big, and thank you, Patricia, the big problem in the United States is that it doesn't get caught early.
because people can't afford to go to the doctor because they don't have health insurance, or they have health insurance with high deductibles or high premiums, and it's a huge hassle. And so in Canada, you just show up and you say, hey, here I am. Oh, cool. All right. 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Every day, I might get a little tired on the weekend. After I draw my pay, I'll go back working. Come Monday morning, I'm right back with the crew. I drank a little beer that evening, sang a little bit of these working man blues.
Well, here's an interesting little news flash. Patty Solis Doyle, the former manager of the Clinton campaign, has now joined the Obama campaign. She will fill the role of chief of staff to the vice presidential nominee, a person as yet unnamed. Well, that's interesting. Does that mean that Hillary will be the vice presidential nominee? The Obama campaign has sent out a press release highlighting a swath of new hires as they gear up for the general election. One of them is Patty Solis Doyle. Doyle will fill the role of chief of staff to the vice presidential nominee. Interesting. Without a vice presidential nominee. So who do you think it's going to be? I don't know. I had reached the point where I was pretty skeptical that Hillary Clinton would be on the ticket, but I could easily build a good case for it. Honestly, don't know. I think I can predict with some reasonably high level of certainty that the Republican vice presidential nominee is going to be Mitt Romney or Bobby Jindal. Probably Mitt Romney. I know that the uber conservatives are not all that fond of him. They would prefer to see Bobby Jindal, who yesterday said that he doesn't believe in evolution. He wants his children taught creationism in the public schools. Yeah. But nonetheless, we'll see. On the Democratic side, man, it is, as far as I can tell, it's pretty wide open. 1-866-303-2270. Dusty in Bainbridge Island, Washington, listening on Talk 1090 KPTK. You had a great point to make about prisons.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Tom. I love your show.
Thank you, Dusty.
You bring up so many great topics. But going back a couple of topics, yeah, mm-hmm. I hear from people, when we go through all the reasons we can't have single-payer good health insurance and coverage for people
Excuse
in our
me.
Country, that one of the things that used to stop me was they'd say, we can't afford it. You know, there's no way, you know, I can't pay 50% of my taxes. Well, I heard on the radio
mm-hmm.
that our state, its top line item for expenditure is justice and corrections. So that would be
right.
all the courts and all the prisons.
Right. We have more people in prison in the United States than any other country in the world, either
mm-hmm.
on a per capita basis or just in absolute numbers, more than China with 1.3 billion citizens.
It's just amazing.
It's a huge industry.
I'm not a person who says that, you know, once somebody gets incarcerated, they should suffer with diseases and not get health treatment. But,
yeah.
you know, okay, so the second line item in Washington State is health coverage for state employees and all the people in prison.
Mm-hmm.
That is, so if we're already paying so much money to a system, but it's sort of it's a kind of a pyramid where people who can't afford health insurance or don't have the kind of employment where they can get health insurance, if your family had two workers and they were, you know, working at McDonald's and waiting tables and doing, you know, they don't get any health insurance.
Right.
But think of all the taxes that they pay so that state workers and you know, people that take care of the prisoners and the prisoners, and you know, this, they're paying for Christine Gregoire to have health insurance.
Yeah, it really is pretty loony when you get right down to it. And Dusty, thanks for calling and making the point. The larger picture here is, where are our priorities? Do we really want to be the nation that has the most people in prison of all nations on earth? I mean, is that really our priority? Number one. And beyond that, number two, do we really want to be the ones who don't offer health care to our own citizens and instead, you know, throw everybody in jail? Is it like the best way to get health care is to go to prison? It's tragic. It really is. Chris in Highland Lakes, New Jersey. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Everything you talk about, I think, goes back to the same thing. I think it's big business. They've taken over the insurance companies, the pharmaceutical companies, and it's the people who the doctors are really answering to. And if we have universal health care in this country, maybe it works in other countries. But I think the corruption going on here is so much that government health care is just going to keep feeding the people that are running these things and that are corrupt. I mean, look, we're not exactly the healthiest nation in the world. I mean, now all the people that smoke are going to have health care. All the people that eat McDonald's every day are going to have health care.
You don't
now,
want them to, Chris?
What?
You don't want them to?
It's not that I don't want them to, but I just feel like if I'm living a healthier lifestyle now, I'm going to be paying taxes for people that aren't. And then you look at our food supply.
Don't you think, Chris, that if all of us were paying for the collective cost of health care, If every single American knew that a good chunk of their taxes was going to pay for health care, and every single American knew that the cost of health care gets driven up by things like smoking, that smoking would become less socially acceptable much more rapidly?
Right, I agree, but I think at the same time, then I think you start losing rights because you start... Then you could start passing legislation.
No, I'm not talking about legislation. I'm talking about social pressure. You're not going to legislate out tobacco use anymore, and you're going to legislate out people smoking pot. Actually, heroin is probably a better example because tobacco is more addictive than heroin. But the bottom line is, you're not going to legislate away that, you know, the use of that drug or the destruction that that drug causes. But what you can do, and what we have seen just in the last 30 years, is a dramatic decrease in the use of tobacco in the United States because it's become socially unacceptable.
Right.
You know, the most effective campaign ad that was done by the Ad Council over the years was the ones where they showed, you know, the guy with missing all his teeth and his puffed in face, and the woman whose face just was ravaged by smoking, basically, and saying, you know, smoke, you know, with a cigarette, saying smoking is sexy. It was far more effective than the scare ads. It was far more effective than all of the other ads that they've done. It was a way of just ridiculing people who smoke, and it created social pressure. I think the social pressure would be even greater if every time somebody smokes, they look around and everybody who's looking at them thinks, someday I'm going to have to pay for the cost of treating that guy's lung cancer.
Right, I agree. Do you know?
So that's an advantage of a national health care system. That's not taking away rights.
Do you know something I found out recently about smoking? I wish we could have a reporter on this. Like, one of the biggest reasons they say the cause for lung cancer is because of the fertilizer they use in the country on tobacco.
Yeah, because it contains uranium.
It's polonium and lead.
That's right. Yeah.
Did you ever talk about Monsanto on your show?
Yeah, we have. Chris, we're wandering far afield here. I got a whole bunch of other callers who want to hop in, but thank you very much for the call. I do appreciate it. Gary in Seattle. Hey, Gary, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom. A Canadian... living in Seattle. I've been here since 95.
Mm-hmm.
So I've kind of lived under both systems, and I've seen the benefits of both, and there are to each one.
Right.
When you're young and healthy, living in America isn't bad. But I think the brilliance of the Canadian system is that the health care isn't tied to your job, and
right.
that pays the dividends when you're old and you retire. In Canada, old people don't lose their home when a spouse gets sick.
Right. And in addition to that, by not tying it to your job, it encourages things like entrepreneurialism. It encourages a movement of labor in ways that allow the markets to reflect demand for labor. So, you know, it's like people don't stay stuck in dead end jobs simply because they have health insurance. They're more, I'm assuming that is the Canadians feel more mobile or at least freer in with regard to employment.
Definitely. Healthcare isn't a consideration in that. It's more job satisfaction.
So, yeah. So if you want to quit your job and start your own business, you don't have to worry about being uninsured, which is a major worry right now in the United States. You know, it used to be 30, 40 years ago, Every small town in America, frankly, every little strip mall in big cities in suburban America were owned by local mom and pop shops. Now it's almost impossible to find local entrepreneurs doing business in the United States. And I think that this whole healthcare problem has a big chunk of to do with that. Gary, thanks very much for the call. I appreciate it. Mike in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, Mike.
Hi. Hi, Tom. I'm sorry if I'm a bit off topic, and if I seem at all disoriented, I should explain that I set my alarm so that I could call you in what for me is the middle of the night. I work nights and I sleep during the day.
Okay.
And I don't get a chance to listen to you on the radio, so I end up listening to you later in the evening when I'm taking a walk or when I'm at work on my MP3 player.
Right. I understand. Mike, we have a minute before the break. A quick question?
Okay, I'll get right to the matter. About a year ago, I read in Newsweek and in The Nation about something that I believe is supposed to be happening in California this month. I haven't heard anything about it since then, and that is that a ballot proposal or a referendum or something changing the way they allocate their electoral votes in the general election.
Right, to be proportional. And to the best of my knowledge, that has died. And it resurrected itself briefly and then it died again.
Enormous relief because, I guess the winner of the popular vote would have gotten the two votes that represent the, the Senate vote, because each state gets two votes.
California's every state's electoral vote is the combination of all their members of the House of Representatives and their two senators. And right now it's winner take all across the United States.
Sure,
and California was going to go basically break it up into multiple whichever.
What I heard was that it would be whoever won the congressional district.
That's right. That's right. As far as I know, Mike, that's dead. Now, stay tuned. Some of our listeners in California who are really wired into this may call and say, no, it's not dead. And in fact, I've heard that there are attempts by the Republicans to resurrect this. There will be attempts right up to the election. But as far as I know, right now it's dead. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. 46, and thanks for the podcasting. 46 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Conservative Christian, right-wing Republican, straight white American male. Soul-saving, flag-waving, rush-loving, land-paving, personal friends to the quail. Quite diligently, working so hard to keep the free brains of this democracy. From tree-hugging, peace-loving, pot-smoking, barefooting, folks singing hippies like me.
Yes. No more of those hippies. 51 minutes past the hour. That's the Tom Hartman radio program. Just a real quickie here before we go to Ellen Ratner. George Bush talking to Adam Bolton of Sky News, Britain's Sky News, yesterday. And their political editor said, I'll let you listen to it in his own words.
I mean, you've talked a lot about freedom. I've heard you talk about freedom, I think, every time I've seen you.
Yes.
And yet there are those who would say, look, let's take Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib and rendition and all those things. And to them, that is the complete opposite of freedom.
Of course, if you want to slander America, you...
Yeah, of course, if you want to slander America, you can mention those things. Oh, my. Ellen Ratner, people slandering America, like the FBI, who issued a report saying that what was done at Guantanamo Bay was illegal. McClatchy newspapers today with this huge investigation they've done all over the world saying perhaps hundreds of men in Afghanistan, Cuba, and elsewhere are there on the basis of flimsy or fabricated evidence, old personal scores, or bounty payments. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen, what's on your mind today?
Things actually. Let's start out with the president saying that they're going to freeze assets of the Iranian bank, and that this is going to be sort of the first steps in terms of what they're going to do with us. This was at this joint press conference with Prime Minister Gordon Brown. and he is going to be part of that. What's interesting about this is, I got to tell you, every time I go down the Dubai River, which is frequent because it's a nice little tourist spot, I see a huge, huge, beautiful new building, which is the Iranian Bank Building. And this is going to have reverberations in a whole lot more than Iran.
So they're going to, what, freeze the assets of the Iranian bank in the United States?
I guess so, and Britain or anywhere else they can get a hold of it.
So this is going to be multilateral. This is the U.S., the U.K., France, the Security Council countries are doing this?
I don't know that France is in on it. At this point, it just looks like Britain, but who knows?
Yeah, but Sarkozy is just gung-ho for this. He's so loving the idea of being the George Bush of France.
Right. So, you know, my guess is he'll come in on it also, but... but at this point today, that was the only thing that was announced.
Huh. Interesting. Okay.
And so President Bush was also asked that, is it possible you got it wrong? Would you share at this point those slightly more reflective sentiments? And the president said that it was the right thing to do for our security. Removing Saddam Hussein was not wrong, was the right thing for peace, was the right thing for 25 million Iraqis. And now he said the fundamental question is whether we're going to have the willpower and patience to help the Iraqis develop a democracy in the heart of the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. And why don't we just listen to them when they say we'd like that they would like us to leave?
Right.
They'd like some sovereignty. I mean, this whole SOFA thing, the status of forces agreements.
Right.
Because,
the one
because
that we can't agree on.
That's right. Because the UN authorization, after when Bush, at the time that Bush invaded Iraq, it was illegal for him to do so because Resolution 1440 called for a Security Council meeting, called for testimony by Hans Blix and Mohammed El-Baradei saying that Iran was in noncompliance, and then called for a vote before any of the member states could attack Iraq. Excuse me. We attacked nonetheless. 6 months later, Bush and some of our allies principally Britain, Tony Blair, got the UN to pass a resolution that said what we did was legal. And that resolution, retroactively, and that resolution is expiring at the end of this year. And so there has to be a new agreement, some sort of new legal framework that makes it legal for the U.S. to continue having troops in Iraq. And the Iraqis, and it has to be negotiated with Iraq, because now we're claiming Iraq is a sovereign country. And the Iraqis are saying, "Nah, we're not sure we want you."
Exactly. I mean, that's my favorite word, but I got to tell you.
Yeah, I love it.
You have it right on that one.
I love it.
Okay, a couple other interesting things. Today, a U.S. District Court judge decided that the White House's Office of Administration is not subject to FOIA laws that would require them to release documents about the missing emails, and that was filed by CRU, the Citizen for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington.
Right.
I'm sure they will appeal that.
Well, that was a release to the public. Now, what about releasing that to Henry Waxman's House Oversight Committee?
I don't know that that is a part of that yet, and that will obviously be a whole different case, and, of course, Henry Waxman can ask for those records.
Right.
As his oversight.
Yeah, I've...
But then they will claim the three branches of government, et cetera.
Yeah, et cetera. Quack, quack, yeah.
The Supreme Court also said that they're going to decide whether Attorney General Ashcroft and Mueller, FBI director, can face lawsuits by prisoners detained after September 11th who said that they were subject to ethnic and religious discrimination. And this was filed by a Pakistani Muslim. He spent 6 months in solitary confinement. He's since been deported to Pakistan. And this went to the appellate court and now will go to the Supreme Court.
Hmm. Over whether when the Bush administration abuses people illegally, they can be sued. I'm assuming that this is a lawsuit against government and not against the individuals personally.
I am not sure. I think it's actually maybe the lawsuit against them personally. My brother's an expert in this, but there's a statute called the 1983 statute. Now, it involves when somebody interferes with your civil rights, but I don't know whether it only refers to the United States citizens or other citizens.
Oh, fascinating. Okay.
And it was not done in 1983, but it's a 1983 statute.
Right. It's like part 1983 of some law or something
exactly.
Like that. Yeah, great.
Yep.
Ellen Rander with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you so much,
Thank
Ellen,
you.
For dropping by. Great talking with you. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be debating attorney and author Stephen Holbrook about guns. Should the Supreme Court uphold the D.C. gun ban? What would the Founding Fathers do?
plus former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman's dropping by with an update on his case, and, of course, the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People. And remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag. You're it. Have a great one. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.